WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Barton Seaver, has dedicated his career to getting people excited about fish, first as a chef, and later as an author and advocate for sustainable seafood. He'd like to see us eating more of the underappreciated species of fish that are not endangered. His new book is called American Seafood, Heritage, Culture, and Cookery from Sea to Shining Sea. Seaver got his start at the Culinary Institute of America and went on to work in several restaurants in the Washington, D.C. area. He left the restaurant industry to become a National Geographic Fellow and now directs the Sustainable Seafood and Health Initiative at the Harvard School of Public Health's Center for Health and the Global Environment. He spoke to us from a studio in Portland, Maine, where he's living, very close to the ocean and lots of fresh seafood. Barton Seaver, welcome to Fresh Air. So you describe your approach to seafood as not exactly a sustainable approach, more like a restorative approach. What's the difference?
Well, I think that we don't have a true historical understanding of what abundance in our waters is or what it was. And so when we talk about sustainability, I think we need to be talking about it in big thinking terms. Let's not just sustain what we have. Let's restore environments. Let's restore ecosystems. And very importantly, let's restore the economies based on them. And let's really build a new legacy in which coastal communities can thrive.
So what are some of the fish that you think fit in the category of working toward a restorative approach? When I say fish, I mean fish to eat.
Well, I think across the board in the United States, we have exemplary fisheries management, and that's based on the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And so in that way, all of our fisheries are managed based on very sound science and best-in-class science, as well as input from regional and local fishers, as well as scientists and economists. That said, from an environmental standpoint, there are species like farm-raised oysters, clams, mussels, scallops, seaweed, or sea greens, they're often called, that don't just maintain quality of ecosystems, they improve them.
So scallops are abundant?
Both in the wild, yes, and more so ever being farmed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what are some of the small fish that are thriving now because of the changing fish ecosystem in the oceans?
Well, nationally, we're beginning to see a resurgence of menhaden, which is not considered a food fish, but has been considered the most important fish in the ocean, in that it is dinner for just about everything bigger than it. But also herring, sardines, we're seeing the slow rise and return of the legacy fisheries in California and other areas in the Pacific Northwest. And I think in many ways also what we're seeing is a renewed interest in these species from a food standpoint. And I think that's very important, that as we see the resurgence of species, we're looking at them from a viewpoint of what is their highest and best use and purpose for us, not just as members of the ecosystem, but part of our economies and part of our idea of what our food system is.
You write that 95% of the fish that Americans eat are from 10 species. So I'm guessing that includes tuna, salmon, flounder, tilapia, halibut. What else?
Well, tuna, salmon, and shrimp actually are about 65% of the total consumption right there, just those three species categories. And then beyond that, we have basically flaky white flesh fish, catfish, pollock, cod, sometimes haddock. You have bassa, swai, tilapia, you know, forms of catfish. And so really, we eat tuna, shrimp, salmon, forms of flaky white flesh fish, and some clams. And that's kind of what Americans eat when it comes to seafood.
Shrimp used to be like a delicacy when I was growing up. They were expensive. You'd eat them for like special occasions. How did shrimp become such a kind of a cheaper, more common food?
Well, that was really the advent of the farmed seafood industry, especially around shrimp, and coming out of cheaper production areas in Southeast Asia as well as throughout Latin America. And so the price of shrimp bottomed out, and also the advent of shrimp as a aspirational food as well came up through sort of the early teens and 20s with its introduction as shrimp cocktail in the hot cuisine temples of New York City, and sort of taken off from there.
So, you know, when it comes to farmed shrimp, I have heard warnings about the quality of the shrimp and the quality of the environment that they're raised in. So what are your thoughts about farm shrimp?
So with farm shrimp, you're right. There are a host of issues associated with that industry. But it's largely a story of bad actors within an otherwise, I think, very positive international story and international industry. When we are making decisions about seafood, we should look to understand how our choices impact ecosystems. And one of the best ways to do that is through best aquaculture practices or the Aquaculture Stewardship Council, both of which are certifications that can help us to understand the provenance and the quality and wholesomeness of products that we're getting and their environmental impacts. But also, I think that there's a story here about volume and value. And with wild capture shrimp here in America, there's a very different product. There's a very different flavor profile, even different flavor profiles amongst different species from different areas. And that's not a conversation we have a lot. You know, we talk about wines in terms of their provenance and the qualities imbued to them by the terroir in which they're grown. But we don't often talk about seafood as being really of a place, tasting of that of those waters and even the cultures that come from it.
I think we talk about it with salmon.
Indeed, indeed.
So I was encouraged to read in your book that you think fish farming is improving. What are some of the improvements that you have seen?
Well, fish farming is, as a global commodity, such a young industry. And the first salmon net pens went into the water in America in the late 1960s. Really weren't a viable large-scale industry until the 1980s. And if you think about how far an industry can have advanced in that time, not only with selective breeding, finding genetic strains within salmon, this is not genetic modification, but selective breeding, finding those that are better suited to being raised in captivity, advances in the feed, you know, how much fish meal or fish oil needs to go in versus replacing some of that with soybeans or corn or algae even to replace some of the omega-3s that we'd find in fish feed. And also antibiotic use. A lot of these issues that have been a legacy sort of character of the aquaculture industry have been solved to a large extent. And the technology to further improve them is ever advancing at a very rapid pace. And so I look at aquaculture as an industry that is ripe, perhaps more so than any other food system, for incredible advances, rapid expansion, and very much improved environmental performance.
So among the fish that you recommend eating because there's an abundance of them, and there isn't a sustainability problem surrounding them, is hake, skate, and cusk. I've eaten skate in restaurants. I don't know that I see it when I buy fish. I don't think I've ever heard of cusk. So tell us about these fish.
Well, these are all fish that come from the New England ground fishery and are part of a long history that we've had of extracting resources from the tempestuous waves of the North Atlantic. And these are species that we've woefully underloved for hundreds of years. We've been so busy and I think sort of married to the fact that we will tell fishermen in the oceans what we're willing to eat for dinner. And well, that has been cod. That we've sort of forsaken some of the other culinary explorations and opportunities that are there. And in doing so, we've created what I call an irrational economy in that telling fishermen and the oceans what we're willing to eat takes away from us the question that says, well, hey, what are you able to provide? And when the answer is hake, it's a beautifully soft, curved, textured flake fish with a wonderful sweetness of its flesh that makes it the fish that fishermen go home with at the end of their days. But we just don't get we don't give ourselves the opportunity to explore these because we're not asking the simple question of, you know, what's the catch of the day? And when we do so, those options suddenly find their way to our plate.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barton Seaver. He directs the Sustainable Seafood and Health Initiative at the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard School of Public Health. And he's the author of the new book, American Seafood. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Barton Seaver, the author of the new book, American Seafood, and the director of the Sustainable Seafood and Health Initiative at the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard School of Public Health. So you used to be a chef, and you had some pretty well-known restaurants in Washington, D.C. So during the years you worked in restaurants, did you see some fish become popular and fashionable and other fish fall off the menu?
Certainly. I was coming up through the ranks when Chilean sea bass was coming up through the ranks. Instantly the darling of the culinary world. Orange roughy, the same. And during my tenure as a chef, I also saw those fish disappear from sales sheets or become priced so exorbitantly that they no longer fit onto my menu space. And that was part of the realization, the rationalization that I had for really beginning to take a second look at the ingredients that I was seeing and not saying just because it's familiar means it's good. I began to really look at seafood as a means to explore not only relationships with the fishers, the farmers that were producing it, but also with the incredible abundance of flavors, of histories, of personalities seafood can bring to our plates.
So why did orange roughy and Chilean sea bass go in and then out of fashion? What accounts for their sudden popularity and then their move off the menu? Because I can't remember the last time I've seen either on a menu.
Well, these are both very slow-growing, deep-water species that live largely in parts of the ocean that are unregulated and sort of unenforced with fisheries management. And so this sort of gold rush mentality to go after these fish, Chilean sea bass, some of them 100 years old or more, orange roughy the same. So that this incredible boom in popularity led to this, you know, massive overexploitation of the species that simply, from a biological standpoint, could not keep up with the demand that we were placing on it. And, you know, species such as those that come to sexual maturity at such an advanced age, sometimes 60, 70 years old.
You're kidding me.
and these are the species that we're going after with such reckless abandon. Of course, they were destined to fail.
Wow. So I had no idea that they didn't reach sexual maturity till that age or that they lived to be like 100. So when you eat a fish that's 100 years old, you've eaten 100 years worth of preparation, and it's going to take another 100 years to replace that fish.
Exactly. And this was part of the reason this was the reason why it collapsed. But the cautionary tale of this takeaway for me is not that fishing those species is necessarily wrong. It's fine if we fish them sustainably, if we fish them with best in class science managing that effort. It's just there's nothing unsustainable about fishing. There's only unsustainable demand. And that's a market pressure. And that's why I think that we as consumers, we as chefs, need to become more educated about the wealth of diversity of seafood that's available to us so that we are celebrating and placing our demand across a broad footprint on the ecosystem rather than these very acute sort of gold rush mentality fisheries that we've seen not work out in our favor or to the environment's favor.
You write about some of the things to look for when you're buying fish, and here's one I didn't think of. Make sure it's been properly eviscerated without puncturing the gallbladder. I didn't even know fish had gallbladders until you mentioned it. How can you even tell if the gallbladder has been punctured when you're buying fish?
Oh, you'll know. There'll be a viscous sort of oily green or a yellow stain on the belly portion of the fish, and that will unfortunately have tainted the entire eating experience. But really, that's something that should – if you're buying fillet fish and you see that, please start shopping at another store.
Right. Okay. You said the surface of the fish should not be dry by sight or by touch, and fish should always have a slight sheen except for scallops. Would you elaborate on that?
The fish should exude this sort of idea that it is still, you know, right from the water, and that when fillets have that glisten to them, that they still are they haven't had time to dry out in a case or have been properly handled and kept on ice the entire time. That's something you want to look for. And with scallops, it's the exact opposite. You know, there's a long history of scallops, which is really just the muscle of a larger animal. It's the muscle that opens and shuts the shell. So it's just that muscle, and there's a long history of those muscles having been treated with various brines to add water weight to them, which is a perfectly legal method. However, you end up with a muscle structure that has been sort of engorged with liquid to the point where it doesn't hold that liquid once cooked, and so you lose any ability to get a sear on it, a good caramelized crunch on the outside. So simply put, look for dry pack or untreated scallops, and this is a means to guarantee that you're going to get a product that is nothing but that muscle, that firm, beautiful muscle that's going to give you all of the sort of piscatorial pleasure that you're looking for.
You say make sure that the fish hasn't been immersed or washed in fresh water. How would you know in a store if it was?
In this case, this is something that you talk to your fishmonger about. Also, if you're looking at behind them and in the sink they have a bunch of fish fillets thawing out in some cold water, well, that's a sign right there that you, again, should be shopping somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But really, the key to getting quality with seafood is simply having a relationship with the man or woman selling you the product.
So is it a bad idea when you get fish home before you cook it to rinse it?
In freshwater, I'd say yes.
What's wrong with a freshwater rinse?
It's just going to wash off some of the flavors that are there, some of the oils that are on the surface. But I do recommend with just about every piece of fish that there is to give it a quick dunk in a low sodium brine, and what this will do is it will help the texture of the fish become a little more taut. It'll give you a little bit more leeway and sort of structural stability during the cooking process. It also, that salt penetrates deep into the muscular structure and begins to sort of just accentuate and highlight the natural flavors. And in doing so, not only do you get a piece of fish that's going to taste better, fuller, more like it is, you're also going to get a piece of fish that's easier to cook and that's going to retain more moisture.
Do you eat red meat or poultry?
I do, but with great rarity, actually. And I have no issue with meat or poultry, but I just find seafood to be so captivating and so interesting in all of its nuances and flavors that here in Portland, Maine, I have opportunity at seafood probably 8 to 12 times a week for a couple meals a day. And I take that opportunity.
So what do you do for the holidays? Do you make fish?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of fish hanging around my house, less so since my wife said I can't hang salt cod in the mudroom anymore. She got hit in the head with it a couple of times, taking off her boots and the excuse that, but honey, it's the mistletoe of the sea. It didn't work. So, but we make a lot of meals based around the Feast of the Seven Fishes idea, a great tradition in the Italian-American heritage. And yeah, seafood's a great thing to entertain with because it's not something that people are really familiar with. And so it's a way to show off and to really have fun with a meal without necessarily getting complicated or, you know, doing some culinary acrobatics, but really just introducing people to new ingredients in fun ways is a wonderful gift in and of itself.
Well, Barton Seaver, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Barton Seaver is the author of the new book, American Seafood, and directs the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard School of Public Health. After a break, Jennifer Egan will talk about her novel, Manhattan Beach, which has been appearing on top 10 lists, including our book critic, Maureen Corrigan's. And film critic Justin Chang and rock critic Ken Tucker will tell us what's on their top 10 lists. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our critics have been making their 10 best lists. Here's film critic Justin Chang with his.
The film world will remember 2017 as a terrible year of reckoning, as the widespread allegations of sexual harassment and abuse against Harvey Weinstein and other Hollywood power players triggered a wave of similar revelations in every sphere of political and cultural influence. Observing the fallout from Los Angeles, the home of the movie industry, it was hard not to feel sickened, heartbroken, and ultimately numbed by the deluge of accusations. It was also that much more of a relief, as a critic, to be able to surrender to the movies themselves. I loved so many of them this year that I wound up settling on 12 favorite titles, which I have ranked as a series of thematic pairings. Good movies speak to us, but also to each other. And in a year marked by stirring calls for solidarity, it feels right to be reminded that greatness is rarely a solo achievement. My favorite movie of the year is Call Me By Your Name, Luca Guadagnino's rapturous Italian summer of love romance, starring the remarkable Timothée Chalamet as a bookish 17-year-old who falls in love with a visiting graduate student, played by an impossibly dreamy Armie Hammer. It's an overpoweringly sensual piece of filmmaking that finds an almost Hitchcockian suspense in the push-pull of feelings that can't be publicly expressed. What stays with you is not just the movie's exquisite imagery, but its piercing, melancholy wisdom about the fleeting nature of pleasure and desire. I'm pairing Call Me By Your Name with my number two film of the year, another sun-splashed coming-of-age story. The Florida Project is Sean Baker's drama about a six-year-old girl named Mooney, played by the astonishing Brooklyn Prince, and her life in a three-story motel complex on the outskirts of Orlando. Shot in retina-searing sherbet hues, it's one of the most wrenching and thrillingly alive evocations of childhood I've ever seen. Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread is next on my list. This is an exquisite chamber piece starring Daniel Day-Lewis in a superb and possibly final screen performance as a 1950s London fashion designer. It's a hypnotic, darkly romantic comedy about creative genius, domestic fulfillment, and the inherently combative relationship between the two. You might say the same thing about my number four choice, Mother, Darren Aronofsky's magnificently unhinged horror thriller come biblical allegory starring Jennifer Lawrence. A lot of people couldn't abide it, but the cinema needs more of Aronofsky's mad, beautiful vision, not less. At number five and number six are two films about the role that communal spaces play in the human quest for knowledge. Ex Libris, the New York Public Library, from the master documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman, spends more than three riveting hours exploring 11 of the library's 92 branches, building a case for this great institution as a cornerstone of the city's social and intellectual life. It would make a lovely double bill with Columbus, a soulful and contemplative first feature from the Korean-American writer-director Kogonada. It stars John Cho and Haley Lou Richardson as two people finding conversation and companionship as they tour the awe-inspiring modernist architecture of Columbus, Indiana. I'm not sure what insanity compelled me to pair Terence Davies' gorgeous Emily Dickinson biopic, A Quiet Passion, with S. Craig Zoller's brutal prison thriller, Brawl in Cell Block 99. But beyond their superficial differences, both movies are, in the end, about two uncompromising individuals retreating from society and descending fearlessly into their own personal solitude. They feature two of the year's best performances, from Cynthia Nixon and Vince Vaughn, respectively. And they're both surprisingly funny. In this scene from A Quiet Passion, Dickinson, played by Nixon, exchanges some wry banter with a friend played by Catherine Bailey.
Will you go with us to church, Miss Buffum?
Of course not. Going to church is like going to Boston. You only enjoy it after you've gotten home.
We are to pray for the repose of our late pastor's soul.
Doesn't that rather depend on where it's gone?
We shall become fast friends.
Of course we shall. I'm irresistible. Everyone says so. When the new pastor does arrive, you must point him out to me.
So that you too may be saved?
No. So that I will know whom to avoid.
Young college-bound women and the overbearing parents who love them, however imperfectly, leave my choices for number 9 and number 10. You've probably already heard about Lady Bird, a pitch-perfect comedy that announces Greta Gerwig as a terrifically deft feature filmmaker and affirms Saoirse Ronan as one of the most gifted actresses of her generation. You may have heard less about Graduation, a gripping moral thriller written and directed by Christian Mungiu, who turns a story of assault and academic dishonesty into a grim indictment of corruption in his native Romania. The final two films on my list are both summer blockbusters, and each one is an inspired marriage of the old and the new. War for the Planet of the Apes, directed with stark, wintry elegance by Matt Reeves, is classicism at its most cutting edge, full of skillful digital illusions that compel our awestruck belief. Christopher Nolan's World War II epic, Dunkirk, is more like old Hollywood avant-garde, a throwback to the glory days of 70mm filmmaking that audaciously bends land, sea, and air, and also time, space, and narrative, to its will. Together, they offer strikingly complementary visions of what Hollywood filmmaking can accomplish.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. After we take a short break, we'll hear from Jennifer Egan, whose novel Manhattan Beach is on our book critic Maureen Corrigan's 10 Best list. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Author Jennifer Egan is not afraid of experimenting with her writing. Her previous novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, included a 70-page chapter comprised only of PowerPoint slides. The book won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. But for her latest book, Egan chose to write a more traditional historical novel. It's called Manhattan Beach. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan included it in her top 10 list this year. The novel takes place during World War II. Anna Carrigan is one of hundreds of women working at the Brooklyn Navy Yard as part of the war effort. She has a boring job measuring tiny parts used in shipbuilding, but she's determined to become the yard's first female deep-sea diver, doing the dangerous work of underwater repairs. She's also recently had a run-in with a mobster named Dexter Stiles, a man she remembers visiting her father when she was a child during the Depression. Her father was a bagman and has disappeared. Anna thinks Stiles may know what's happened to him. Jennifer Egan spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.
Well, Jennifer Egan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So much of this book takes place on the New York City waterfront, but it's amazing how now you can walk around New York and go days or months without even thinking about the water.
It's true. I think that was one thing that really got me excited about the waterfront. I was initially interested in New York during World War II. I think that was the first impulse, maybe dating from 9/11, when New York suddenly felt like a war zone overnight. And as I began looking at images of New York during the war, and what struck me so forcefully was just the omnipresence of water, the sense of everything inclining out toward the edges, as opposed to now where the city seems to kind of tilt in toward the middle. And I felt like the waterfront itself basically led me into various different realms that I ended up working with in the book.
Your main character, Anna, is one of the many women working at the Navy Yard. Women got jobs there after the soldiers left and are working there as part of the war effort. So were women restricted from the certain kinds of work they were allowed to do there? Like in your research, did you find that there were double standards in how they were treated at the yard?
Absolutely. I mean, at the beginning, first of all, they were not allowed on ships for the first couple of years that they worked at the yard. There was a feeling that, you know, no good could come of men and women in such close quarters. Ultimately, I think the women protested and were allowed on the ships. And in fact, it worked very much to the advantage of the Navy Yard to have them on the ships, because ships are, of course, very compressed spaces. And women tended to be slighter, more limber, and more dexterous than the men. So female riveters and welders and plumbers actually had some real advantages on the ships over men. But that was just one example. I mean, at the beginning, women were always what they called helpers, meaning that they were assisting someone doing whatever the job was rather than doing it themselves. But gradually, it did begin to happen, especially as more and more men headed overseas.
Well, speaking of that, Anna wants to become a Navy diver. What kind of work did divers do at the Brooklyn Navy Yard?
Diving was a really important part of ship repair, because divers would go in and examine what was wrong with the ship from underneath. And divers would also patch ships from the outside sometimes. But also what divers did a lot of was salvaging. Divers helped to clear out the harbors after the Germans fled and blew up lots of things to keep the Allies from using the harbors. They were an extremely important part of the war effort, both militarily and in a civilian setting.
Well, talk about the suits they wear. You actually got to try one on. These are not the sleek wetsuits that you see people wearing today. These are these giant, heavy things. I mean, you're putting a huge metal helmet on your head.
Yeah, I mean, these are basically the Mark V, which is the heavy gear that was worn, in fact, into the 60s. Still, this apparatus was current, weighs about 200 pounds, and it is the iconic diving suit that any of us can picture, with the big cylindrical helmet with the round window in the front and on the sides, the big heavy boots, and the lead belt. And I did watch people dive in it, which was great. And in fact, I saw someone blow up, which is what they call when the air pressure goes awry and too much air goes into the canvas part of the diving suit. The diver is spread-eagled and cannot adjust the air pressure to stop the suit from blowing up, and then the diver pops to the surface like a cork.
There's a lot known about this period of time when there's large numbers of women entering the workforce to replace men who'd left for the war, and how once the war was over, they were kicked out of those jobs to make room for the returning soldiers. But what did you learn about the period that's less well known?
For example, there was a woman named Ida that I interviewed who was a welder and extremely proud of her welding abilities, and actually had some real seniority in the Navy Yard by the time she was fired, like the other women, and had a lot of respect for her welding skills. And she was a working class woman who still needed to work after the war. So she thought quite reasonably that she could be hired as a welder because she was so good at it. And she described being laughed at repeatedly when she would go to apply for welding jobs. And that was really powerful to think about, you know, that women were told their whole lives that they could not do this kind of work, then begged to do it, because that's what the Rosie the Riveter campaign was all about, getting women to want to do this, and proving that they could do it really well, and then mocked for even imagining that they might continue to do it.
While you were writing Manhattan Beach, your brother died. He'd been struggling with schizophrenia, and he committed suicide. He was an artist, and in your acknowledgments, you write that he taught you the necessity of gunpowder in any work of art. What did you mean by that?
Well, I don't know what I mean by it or exactly what he meant by it, but he had an uncanny ability to say the right thing at the right time. I mean, he was the most reasonable, crazy person you've ever met. I mean, he was adored on all sides and was capable of reliably giving excellent advice. And so I remember it was actually when I was working on the PowerPoint chapter of A Visit from the Goon Squad, which I was having a lot of trouble making work. And we had dinner and he said something about how I just had to make sure I was using enough gunpowder. And it would work if I did, that's what really mattered. The way I took that was, I need to just let it rip a bit more. I'm not fully there's more energy I can unleash here. He was a wonderful person to consult with, and we had a lot in common. There are a lot of similarities between hearing voices in a psychotic way and writing fiction. Tremendous number of similarities.
Yeah, well, you said that he would joke that as a writer, you were getting paid for the voices in your head, whereas he was paying to get rid of the ones in his. He was an artist, and how did his art relate to his mental illness? Did you try to get a better understanding of what was going on with him by looking at his art?
It was impossible because his art was quite beautiful, but it was all coded descriptions of his illness, but he would never explain the code. And so we never knew. You know, every color had a meaning. It was all allegory, really. I sort of like that, actually. I like the thought that I have this beautiful work that contains whole messages and descriptions of his inner life that maybe I can intuit, but I can't actually perceive them narratively.
Do you have his art in your house?
Yes, I do. And I look at it all the time, and it's a wonderful keepsake. I mean, I wish he were here, and I think about him constantly. But I understand why he finally felt like he just ran out of energy to fight. He hung in there a really long time and managed to have, in some ways, a joyful life. But it was just terribly draining to have to contend with so much noise in his brain. And it was impossible to medicate the noise away without turning himself into a zombie. I mean, I don't know what I would have done in his place. I think he was a very strong man, very brave. I used to say to him that he was like someone who had done, you know, 8 tours in some terrible war zone, and we could sit down and have dinner and laugh, and he was very funny. But in the end, he had to go back out. He had to go back into that battlefield, and it was impossible for any of us to change that, no matter how much we loved him.
Did his death influence the way you finished the book?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I already knew all the important stuff by the time that happened. It did provide a tremendous solace for me, though. I've never felt more the good fortune of having an alternate reality to escape into. It was such a haven for me to live in a different time among different characters. And I also, you know, he took a lot of pride in any success that I had. Mm-hmm. He felt as if that was his success too, I think. He was excited because he felt like we were so much the same that it was just amazing that I could do well. He couldn't believe it. Mm. It was very sweet. Mm. So, you know, I knew that he would certainly want me to continue, and he would be chortling if things went well. So I just proceeded.
I guess it's particularly comforting that you try not to mine your life for inspiration for your books so that it's a real divorce from your reality.
True. Although there are a lot of mentally unstable characters in my books, and I think that my love for him is everywhere present in my work. I feel such sympathy for people whose minds won't line up with the dominant mainstream consensus on what is real. I mean, it's just a tremendous handicap to have to deal with. I think about it constantly, you know, just the good luck of having sound mental health. It's such a gift. And so many people don't have it.
Well, Jennifer Egan, thanks for being here today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Egan's latest novel is Manhattan Beach. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. After a break, rock critic Ken Tucker will tell us what's on his 10 best list. This is Fresh Air.